judges of the United States Court of Appeals in and for the 7th Judicial Circuit. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before this honorable court are admonished to draw near and give their attention, as the court is now sitting. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Before we start, I will say for the record that we are accompanied by Judge Rovner, who is at the Federal Courthouse in Springfield, Massachusetts, but on the video, so you will hear her intervene from time to time when she wishes. So we are, in fact, all three here. So our first case for this morning is Cook County, Illinois, against Chad Wolf. Mr. Sinzak.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. Jerry Sinzak, appearing on behalf of the United States. The district court's preliminary injunction is flawed in several respects and should be set aside. As a threshold matter, plaintiffs fail to assert a cognizable injury, and moreover, they seek to insert an interest, greater use of benefits by aliens that is diametrically opposed to the public charge provision.
Now, Mr. Sinzak, we're reviewing Judge Feinerman's grant of a preliminary injunction for an abuse of discretion. The district court's decision here is in line with decisions made by district courts in the Northern District of California, the Eastern District of Washington, the Southern District of New York, and the District of Maryland. Other courts may, but can we really say that the district court abused its discretion in the balance of the harms in granting this short-term preliminary relief?
Yes, Your Honor. I mean, of course, to obtain a preliminary injunction, plaintiffs have to establish all the elements of the injunction, including a likelihood of success on the merits, and they have not done so here. In terms of the balance of the harms, we also feel they have not done that either, as the Ninth Circuit and the Fourth Circuit, as well as now the Supreme Court, has concluded that the balance of harms in the public interest weighs in favor of the government, or at least in favor of allowing the rule to go into effect. On the merits, you know, as the Ninth Circuit held, this rule easily accords with and is a reasonable interpretation of the public charge provision.
So, of course, that is what we need to discuss. Judge Barrett?
I was just going to say one thing that would be helpful to me is for you to tell me exactly who is subject to the public charge provision. As far as I can tell, you know, refugees and asylum seekers, you know, those whose socioeconomic status would be most closely tied to their immigration status, are excluded. So am I correct that the public charge rule applies primarily to family immigrants, those who are coming on employment visas, and then lottery winners, green card lottery winners?
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, those are the primary categories.
And none are eligible for aid, with some minor exceptions.
I mean, they are eligible after a certain number of years.
After they have green cards, after the 5 years?
That's correct, yes.
Right. So they're in this period, the public charge rule is counting against them aid they're not entitled to receive anyway.
No, I mean, the public charge provision provides that an adjudicator has to determine whether at any time in the future a person is likely to become a public charge. So at the moment they're being evaluated, they may not have received them, but the question is whether in the future they are likely at any time to receive them. So that is the test, and that is what the rule sets forth a number
right.
of factors.
And so, I mean, there's so many things we can talk about, and I think I'm going to put to one side your opening argument about standing, although I do think the government, at least with respect to Cook County, has more or less conceded standing. But putting that to one side, one of the things that concerns me is precisely about this five-year look forward that the background law requires you to make. Because I look down the factors beyond the statutory factors and the way that you're weighing them, and I find no empirical evidence in this record to support the type of inference that you're drawing. And indeed, some of them just seem to be plucked out of thin air, like the idea that you should hold family size against somebody because that means they're more likely to become a public charge. It's actually quite to the contrary. In most countries, a large family is a way that they provide a social safety net. English proficiency, to say that somebody who doesn't speak English well today, 5 years out, isn't going to be actually bilingual and a more competitive worker in the workforce, seems to me at least something that needs support. And I don't find that support in this record.
Your Honor, I mean, I guess I just want to emphasize, of course, this is a totality of the circumstances test. So.
But you can't, 0 + 0 = 0. So if correct. You are throwing in a lot of factors that you have not supported with empirical evidence that would allow a rational person to see that this individual is likely to become a quote public charge, and I do want to talk about what that means, but if the evidence doesn't lead there, then it can't take part in the totality of the circumstances.
Yes, and to answer your honest question more directly, there is empirical evidence in the record. There was the agency in its notice of proposed rule explained at length and showed studies, for example, exemplifying that English proficiency is something that is associated with higher unemployment, is associated with greater benefits, use a low English proficiency. And the agency made clear that it will consider language proficiency in general. If a person is bilingual, that would be a positive factor weighing.
But why does the agency think that people will plug up their ears for 5 years and not learn any English during this waiting period that the law imposes?
Well, Your Honor, I mean, you know, it is, again, a series of factors that—
No, but don't tell me that. I mean, let's focus on this one. Why, what evidence does the agency have about the learning curve for English proficiency from people of various age groups who enter the United States?
Your Honor, I'm not sure there's evidence of
there
that
isn't
particular,
any.
But again—
Right, which is Congress critical, because if the person is poor in English today, but by 5 years later with practice, is now perfectly competent in English, then you can't hold English proficiency against them.
Well, again, it's an estimate of how likely someone is to be, and we
based
know there's evidence
what?
Showing that people who are not proficient in English.
Based on what does that evidence come? Do you have data about—
There's certainly data that low English proficiency now. I don't know
no,
if there's
no,
data.
No, but data about somebody who enters today, 5 years from now, is still not going to be able to speak English.
I'm not aware of anything in the record on that particular point, but
all right,
counsel. I'm glad that Chief Judge Wood is asking this question, because it goes to a question that I have about exactly the posture of the case and what you're arguing. A lot of this back and forth seems to me that it has to do with the APA questions of arbitrary and arbitrary and capricious review, right?
That's correct.
Okay, and here, can you articulate for me, because you say it slightly differently in your brief in different places, what is your definition of public charge in the statute?
The definition is whether someone is likely at any time to use one of the specified benefits.
Okay, I'm so glad you said that, because I thought that that's what you were saying too. And what bothers me is I think you've tried to rewrite this statute. Using one benefit isn't the same thing, in my view, taking an ordinary dictionary understanding of the notion of public charge. You know, getting one meal at a soup kitchen surely does not make you a public charge any more than I'm my neighbor's responsibility if I have dinner over at his house. And the way you've done it is actually you could become, according to the government's approach, a quote public charge in 2 days, if you used 6 benefits one day and 6 benefits the next day, the way you're stacking months.
And is that really your position?
That is not our position at all, Your Honor.
But
that
that's
not,
what you've
that is not
argued.
How the rule works.
That is
how,
you've argued it. You've said if you use 2 things, that counts as 2 months.
Counsel, is it the case? So in your brief, you say the rule renders inadmissible aliens who are likely to rely on government support for a significant period to meet basic needs. I took it to be that definition, which you state in slightly different ways at different points in your brief, was your interpretation of public charge in the statute. And then the regulation, which obviously has a lot more detail than that, was your effort to implement in a specific way that understanding of the statute. Am I misunderstanding? Because you're telling Judge Wood something different now.
I don't believe I am. That is our view. And I just want to be absolutely clear. We are not talking about the use of one benefit, you know, for one day or even two benefits for 2 days.
Well, where do we see that in the regulation?
The regulation says you have to use more than 12 months worth of benefits.
But then you define a month to be one benefit. You very clearly say repeatedly in your brief that if you use two benefits inside 1 month, that counts as 2 months. And so it seems to me if you use 12 benefits inside of 1 month, as somebody might who has temporarily lost a job, looking for a new job, finds the new job 6 weeks later, that person has used up their entire allotment for the 36-month period.
If I can just elaborate.
Judge Rovner has a question.
Suppose a non-citizen awaiting eligibility for citizenship needs a bit of assistance to get on his feet. If he needs housing assistance, SNAP, and Medicaid until he gets settled, he could be deemed a public charge for needing just 4 months of assistance, correct?
That's correct. And I would like to elaborate because I want to make something clear on this point. The agency considered the universe of possible benefits, and it narrowed that universe down to, and if we're talking about non-cash benefits, just three: Medicaid, with exceptions, housing vouchers, and a SNAP program. So food, shelter, and medical care. Those are the only benefits that qualify. So you could only ever use three benefits.
Only the most important three things that a person
needs.
But housing, food, and
basic necessities. Basic necessities. So if you're talking about someone for 4 months who's relying on the government for food, for shelter, for medical care, that looks a lot like someone who's permanently reliant or primarily primarily reliant on the government.
No, it doesn't at all. And as a matter of fact, the government should recognize that on the Medicaid side, it's financial lunacy to have somebody forced over to the emergency room who could be very inexpensively treated in advance. I worried, one of the amici had a footnote about the coronavirus. I don't know why the government thinks it's better for people not to go to the doctor to get a simple test to see if they have become infected with this, we hope not pandemic, but very serious.
And the rule excludes emergency medical care. So.
But that's the thing. You have to go to the emergency room. You're not going to go to see the doctor. You're not going to go to the CVS one-minute clinic.
But counsel, do you want us to get into all of this at this stage? Because Judge Feinerman didn't. And I'm kind of surprised at the turn the argument's taking, because I would have thought that you were going to be talking primarily about the Chevron Step 1 argument that the district court rested its decision on, about whether indeed that term public charge requires primary and permanent dependence, rather than these factors. It seems to me that if the district court was wrong about that, if public charge also encompasses some kind of like a significant period that's not necessarily permanent, and dependence that is significant but not necessarily total, then it's a separate question that the district court didn't get into, because it's Chevron Step 1 holding, whether the factors that you've identified actually make sense. Am I?
No, Your Honor is correct. I mean, the district court held on Chevron Step 1 grounds, and in both the district court and plaintiffs' argument really hinges on the idea that there was this longstanding fixed definition that Congress adopted.
But there is also no doubt that Step 2 was fully briefed in the district court. The district court chose not to reach it, but no one should be surprised, even if we were to grant you that the language used in the Gegyu case was perhaps not, you know, in context completely dispositive, the permanency, but you do seem to be conceding that very impermanent use, of a very short usage of benefits is not enough to make somebody a public charge.
Well, I mean, the agency in the rule itself and in setting forth this 12-month threshold said that, no, we're going to take a middle ground position.
But
we're
it's not a 12-month threshold. I really take exception to your calling it that, given your own definition of it.
12 months of benefits usage threshold.
Which could happen in 1 month.
It could not happen in 1 month.
Yes, it could.
No, it could not, Your Honor.
Well,
I don't understand. There could only be three benefits that you could use, plus cash assistance of four. But that would not, I don't understand how you could get
to. So you go by the month instead of by the day? Where do you say that?
that the rule says 12 months of benefits. I'm not sure the exact part, but that is, I don't think plaintiffs or the district court to be saying that.
If you go to the doctor every day in a month, that counts as 1 month if you're doing it under Medicaid?
Yes. So it can't be the case that you could be found to be a public charge for 1 or 2 days worth of benefits.
All right, so 4 months. Take Judge Rovner's hypothetical.
Yes, 4 months. So that means for 4 months, you've been relying on the government for, or you're expected to rely on the government for food, housing, and shelter.
You know, there's a gotcha here, too, because many people in the categories Judge Barrett mentioned are not allowed to work by the government. So if a spouse comes in or if a family member comes in, they are not very often immediately given a green card to go work. They're told, no, you actually can't work because you're not, you know, we haven't given you permission yet. And you're going to say that that, nonetheless, should be held against them.
Your Honor, I'm not familiar with that particular hypothetical. I don't take anyone to be arguing that.
They can't get benefits either, right?
They can't get benefits. They can't work.
But they may have skills that the adjudicator will take into account. I mean, they may have financial resources. Many people are required to get an affidavit of support.
Well, those people are different. I really think we need to put those people to one side. For the people who get the affidavit of support, there's an elaborate statutory scheme. Those are enforceable. I don't think we're talking about those people. But
I think, well, this is why it's so complicated. I think we might be, which is why I'd like you to help me out here. I thought that the people who had affidavits of support, I thought that the people subject to the public charge rule were these people that Judge Wood is talking about.
Yes.
Who have affidavits of support or who are coming to work for Google, and so they have to have employer backing.
That's correct. I mean, the vast majority of people, family, certainly the family visas, have to obtain an affidavit of support. And
so why does the government have that? That sounds even more absurd to me. Because if there is an affidavit of support, it's exactly like some of these earlier cases where there was assurance to the government that it would be reimbursed for whatever expenditures it made. And so there's no public charge whatsoever. It's on private shoulders.
And that is a factor that is taken into account, and that could well
be someone. But you can't be a public charge if you have an affidavit of support.
No, I mean, the affidavit of support lasts generally for about 10 years. And so,
right, so well beyond
the five. And it could be less. And so the question is whether at any time. But I do want to get back to Judge Barrett's overall point and the district court's question about whether this term has an unambiguous meaning that Congress adopted. And there's no evidence in the record of that. In fact, the evidence goes exactly contrary to that.
But isn't the evidence pretty clear? I guess I just want to say which end of the telescope we're looking through. Even if you're right that there's no evidence that the permanency factor that was mentioned quickly by Justice Holmes in the Gegu case isn't baked into the word charge, you couldn't be a public charge for a very short period of dependency or use of, maybe not even dependency, use of government benefits. Medical care, for example, people can skip. People do skip it, and this record indicates many people are skipping it.
Well, I mean,
so, I mean, if the government wants to create a pandemic, go ahead, I guess. But, you know, it seems very foolish.
Well, I mean, in part, the government, you know, under this rule will not be admitting individuals who would be likely to rely on public benefits as well. So,
but that's not before us, right?
We're allowing
them
to permanently adjust.
We're here right now.
We're
not
primarily talking about people who are adjusting status. That is correct.
Right, and so the people who came in under affidavits of support are not allowed to use Medicaid if they wish later to adjust their status and to avoid having a negative factor on their record. So they should be well advised to stay away from a doctor's office.
No, I mean, they should be advised to use private resources.
Are they eligible for Medicaid?
Generally, they are not. And so, yeah. I mean, for
after 5 years, are they eligible?
It would depend on their particular circumstances. Under the affidavit of support, the sponsor is required for paying for whatever medical care they get. And so if they were eligible, then the sponsor would. But I think what the sponsorship provision indicates is that, you know, plaintiffs are here saying that this term has a fixed meaning and it can only apply to long-term usage.
Because the word public charge, if we can get away from, you know, the heat of the present debate, means you're dependent on the government. If you're somebody's charge, there's a sense of dependency, there's a sense of responsibility, and something very brief doesn't count. What about school lunches?
Well, Your Honor, we're not here...
Means-tested school lunches.
Your Honor, we're not here defending that particular thing. In fact, and the agency didn't consider that as one of the means-tested benefits. Again, it focused on these three means-tested benefits going to
SNAP,
housing...
SNAP,
housing, food, and medical care.
So you consider those significant. Going back to the definition in your brief, rely on government support for a significant period to meet basic needs. Your definition in your brief implies some degree of dependence. So I would have thought that your answer to Chief Judge Wood would be that, yes, a public charge is someone who is dependent on the government, even if for supplemental support as opposed to permanent support. But what I hear you saying now is that someone who receives any support that even isn't dependent, is that what you're saying?
No, I don't mean to be...
Because something you could forego is something that's optional. So if somebody can just say, well, I have an earache, but I'm not going to go to the doctor because it's going to count against me for my immigration, my efforts later to adjust status. Or they say, I am living in a shelter, but I'm not going to try for Section 8 because that's, going to count against me. And actually, I want to get back to this list of criteria. So many of them are troublesome. You're looking at things like, do you have skills, certifications, or licenses? But those things people don't necessarily show up in the United States with. And if they are barred from working, it's going to be hard for them to get, a plumber's license or, a certification of some sort of thing, for that matter.
Well, I just want to a couple on that particular point. I mean, Congress required in the statute that the agency consider a person's education and skills.
Sure.
And not only that, people who are adjusting status could be here for a while before they do that, so they could develop these skills. And
if they are not barred from the path to do it. No,
well,
I mean,
you
added
licenses.
They're
here legally, they have a visa as a family member. They, I don't know all this, the immigration laws on whether they can work or not, but they have time. But they have time to become proficient in English. So by the time they're applying, if they are, they've been here for a while, and they can demonstrate that they're proficient in multiple languages, then that will be counted in their favor. So
of the fact that one provision of the 1882 Act established the public charge exclusion, while a different provision of the 1882 Act created an immigrant fund to provide for immigrants who fell into distress or need public aid. Doesn't that alone show that Congress did not intend to exclude immigrants who needed short-term aid?
No, it doesn't, Your Honor. I think what's key about that provision is it was a tax imposed on ship owners and, in some cases, the immigrants themselves. It was not a fund funded by the public, and it did not make people a public charge.
It was paid by shipmasters. How is that different than any other tax established to create a social safety net?
Earmark.
Because those are paid for by the public generally, not by the people directly benefiting from
But counsel, I see that point because public charges, especially in the poor laws in the 19th century, did kind of morph from using public charge to mean charge on the public to gradually being used to refer to people who needed the aid. I get your point about it being funded by the immigrant fund and not the public. Nonetheless, as Judge Rovner is pointing out here, if you are reliant, it would still be a factor or a gauge if you're reliant on this immigrant fund for help getting on your feet. It's not necessarily then a sign of any kind of longer term dependence.
Well, we don't know any of the details about that level of support. Was that 1 month's worth of support? Was it non-cash or cash?
Know some about that. I've found some about that.
Well, in any event, what we're talking about here and what the rule is saying is if you use 12 months of over, including the aggregation point, but
Counsel, it cannot be that that's what you think it means, because if you're saying that it means that something that specific,
I'm not saying that that's what it means as a general matter. I mean, it is a, it's been clear from the beginning, from 1882, that Congress set down a broad, capacious term that Congress itself, the BIA, has recognized has had varied interpretations.
Not very much. Not until this rule. I don't want to cut off this discussion, but your time is almost up.
Yes.
And I know you wanted 5 minutes for rebuttal. I will probably give you some extra time, but if you would like to
thank you.
Wrap up at this point, it might be a good idea.
Yes. You know, I think we've covered a lot of ground here. I mean, again, the district court's holding was on, and the plaintiff's argument is that this term has an unambiguous meaning, and it certainly does not. It has a broad meaning since 1882, and Congress has recognized that and has deliberately left it to the executive branch to interpret the term and given it broad discretion to
okay.
do so. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sinsdag. Next, we'll hear from Ms. Flint.
Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Tacey Flint on behalf of Plaintiff ICER. With the Court's leave, I will spend my argument time focusing on the statutory interpretation questions, and my colleague, Mr. Morrison, in his time will focus on standing and the remaining injunction factors, although, of course, both of us are happy to do our best to answer any question you have. To begin, on the statutory interpretation.
Start you off, please. It's difficult, you see, because there's a lag. How do you suppose someone who is a public charge was different than someone who is a pauper in the 1907 Immigration Act?
In the 1907 Act, pauper and public charge certainly do have overlap. Public charge is a broader term than pauper. Several of the cases from that era talk about public charge. Someone could be a public charge if they reach primary dependence on government support as a result of poverty, poverty and insanity, poverty and physical disability. There are multiple grounds on which a person could become a public charge, whereas pauper is a more specific term.
Can I ask you this? Your primary argument, as I understand it, is that the district court was correct to stop this analytical process at step one of the Chevron framework. And I'm going to assume for the sake of this court that the Chevron framework is alive and well and that nobody has done anything to it yet. So that's what we need to follow. The word public charge, as we've been discussing and as we have mountains of briefs to show, does not strike me as one of those things like saying you need to be 35 years old that everybody can figure out. What does that mean? Maybe a little all year or part of the year, but the term public charge, I think we've established, could mean primarily dependent on the public, so that the public is providing, let's say, more than half of somebody's support. It could mean 100% dependent on the public. It could mean that the public is supplementing, and it's sort of more like 30%. Maybe at some point, if we got down to episodic and occasional uses of public resources, just to tide over a brief period of time, I'll say down to the 10% level, maybe that doesn't fit, but surely there's some interpretation that needs to happen for this word, isn't there?
Let me answer your question in two ways. First, the term public charge does have a fixed and unambiguous meaning. The district court was correct to find that. The meaning is primary dependence.
And where do you get that from? I mean, do you get that from Gegu, or do you get that from
many?
It's certainly not the statute. The statute doesn't say, and here's the definition section.
That's correct. The statute doesn't say, here's the definition section. But we get it from all of the tools that are appropriate for interpreting a statute. Statutory context, including the context that Judge Rovner raised during my colleague on the other side's argument, the 1882 provision for temporary relief, And we get it, probably most obviously, from the history of judicial interpretation that had happened over a century before Congress reenacted the term in 1996. Everyone agrees that this term has meant the same thing from 1882.
Everyone doesn't agree, as the mountains of briefs, you know. Everyone doesn't agree. And there was confusion. I mean, there was an early Treasury regulation where the Treasury was trying to give instruction on what public charge meant because people weren't quite sure. And different, actually, Cook County was very generous and said it wasn't going to report to the government people who were receiving outdoor relief, while California, not so generous. There were differences in enforcement and some confusion. So to pinpoint it at any particular point is kind of hard to do.
Well, as far as the federal statute is concerned, the parties, in this case at least, the government and the plaintiffs, agree that the term has meant the same thing from when it was enacted in 1882 through the 1996 statute. Every enactment, the five enactments that followed 1882, did not change or attempt to redefine the statute. And over that time, the statute was interpreted by dozens of courts, including Geggio by the Supreme Court in 1915. And those cases are consistent. They reject a determination of public charge status if someone is using transient benefits, using most of the things you described, Chief Judge Wood, that are anything other than primary dependence on
counsel. Government. I want to ask you a question about your in-kind and cash point. I really don't understand that point, because in the late 19th century into the 20th century, outdoor relief, poorhouses, for example, are an in-kind benefit. And outdoor relief primarily consisted of fuel, of food, those kinds of things. And in some jurisdictions, I mean, this was a county-to-county thing under the poor laws. In some jurisdictions, poorhouses became out of fashion, and so they primarily cared for even those primarily and permanently dependent with in-kind help. So I don't understand the government's choice to give you housing as opposed to giving you the cash for housing, why that's significant to you.
Thank you, Your Honor. This highlights a really crucial distinction, the distinction between what the word public charge means and how the agency chooses to apply the definition when it determines who is likely to become a public charge. The term public charge has not changed. It has a fixed meaning. The agency has, over time, changed how it determines who is likely to become a public charge. And exactly as you observed, in the past, institutionalization was the common means of handling and helping poor people who needed government assistance, or they were primarily dependent on government assistance. That, of course, is not how the world works anymore in most cases. So now, when the agency determines who is likely to become a public charge, it focuses on benefits. And that was true of the 1999 guidance as well.
What percent of non-citizens who require public assistance still need that assistance in, say, 5 to 7 years?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't think the record answers that question, or if it does, I don't know it. But the agency's rule applies to, it finds someone likely to become a public charge if at any time beyond 5 years, or, you know, in many decades, they will ever accept 12 months of benefits over a 36-month period.
And counsel, just to clarify your answer, you didn't really quite answer my question that I asked before. You say that it's part of the public charge definition that in-kind benefits can't count.
No, I don't believe that is part of the statutory definition. That is how the agency has interpreted it in the 1999 field guidance.
And it's not free. I mean, putting aside, you know, questions of whether they adequately explained this shift for purposes of the APA, putting aside that, you're simply saying that because the agency for a long time excluded in-kind benefits, that now they can't count them?
No, I am not saying that. If the agency says...
So maybe some of the amici said that, but if you're not saying it, that's helpful to know.
Yeah.
As the world exists with the benefits that exist right now, I don't think the term public charge someone could be found likely to be a public charge based solely on the use of supplemental benefits.
So
but
is the, diff- is the difference...
Term. That's based on what statute, how benefits work right now.
So is the difference use of benefits that are generally available to the public as a whole? I mean, I assume immigrants drive on the roads, too, and the roads are paid for by tax dollars, but we don't tell them they can't drive in the roads. So where's the line there between the things that are targeted to people who have some economic need?
That's a great question. And we, as you observed earlier, Judge Barrett, we don't have a clear definition of the term public charge from the government. Obviously, the rule explains how they define public charge for purposes of the rule, but it doesn't say how they interpret the statute. You raised a quote from their brief.
Don't they say, actually, I mean, I find this somewhat troublesome, but don't they say that because the statute says in the opinion of the Attorney General, which they say we should now consider the opinion of the Secretary of Homeland Security, might be some issues about that, but we'll put that to one side, that there's actually no limit, that I mean, the Attorney General could decide that people with red hair are public charges, and that would be fine.
That is close to their argument. They certainly believe that the statute gives the agency great discretion. And
I read them to say unfettered, actually.
And throughout this litigation, they've taken the position that charge is liability, and a public charge is someone who imposes a liability on the government. In their reply brief, they tried to narrow their interpretation of the statute. I believe that was what Your Honor was quoting.
No, it was from their blue.
Their blue brief. But in their briefing in this case, they tried to narrow it in this appeal. But that's not the position they took before, for one thing, in the district court. And for another thing, that's not consistent with the way the rule works. They're now saying that maybe we can interpret the statute to mean public benefits for an extended period of time. But as Your Honor observed, the rule would cause someone to be determined to be likely to be a public charge after 3 months. That is consistent with what the rule provides. And it's hard to imagine that that is what anyone would consider an extended period of time.
Well, there's data. What bothers me about this rule is really it's very anecdotal, I guess, and if you look at the record. And there, you would want data to show, for example, if somebody is laid off from a job, what's the median time for finding a new job? Because if that's all it is, you know, people don't actually normally just walk out of one job and show up the next day at the next job. That would seem to me to be not so unusual as you would call it a public charge. Mm-hmm. It's just a brief helping hand that many people take advantage of, as a matter of fact.
And that is exactly what the history of case law says. I mean, when Congress most recently enacted the term public charge in 1996, it had dozens of cases interpreting the term in front of it. Now, I don't need to march through them. The district court did, the briefs in this court do. But I can represent to you, I've read all of these cases, and as I read them, there is not a single case where a court says, yes, it is acceptable to determine that someone is a public charge based on short-term, minimal use of benefits.
So when does someone become a public charge? So Chief Judge Wood gave you examples before, someone who's 52% reliant, or you know, 80% or 30%. What, in your view, is 2 years long-term enough dependence, you know, to qualify as a public charge?
The statute says, or the statute means, primary dependence for the long term.
So what is primary?
Benefits for subsistence. The agency is free to determine who is likely to
what
become.
What is the amount of time a person would need to receive government assistance before it would be reasonable for the government to consider her a public charge?
What I can say is it has to be more than certainly the 3 months that is permitted, or the 12 months that would, even the 12 months that would happen if you only used one benefit at a time.
Could you say a word about disabled people? Because that's another factor that's heavily weighed against someone.
Are you, well, we've argued.
Some of the amicus briefs focused on that, but the statutory scheme has actually special provisions about people who are HIV positive, for example, who will need a lifetime of medicine.
Right. So we argued that the district court didn't need to reach, but we argued that Section 504 precludes disability as a but-for cause of excluding someone from the country.
The reason I'm asking some of these questions, I'll just put the cards on the table, is the district court resolved this at Chevron Step 1. If one did not agree that that was correct, if we thought that this term public charge has enough play in the joints that it requires some interpretation, then you have to move to Chevron step two.
Correct.
Chevron step two is not an automatic victory for the government. Chevron step two has its own set of inquiries, and some of the questions, at least I've been asking, stem from my interest in how that works out.
That's right. So Chevron step two asks whether this is a reasonable application of the statute, and I think perhaps it's even more clear that this is not a reasonable application of the statute. Public charge was enacted with a Congress that incorporated a well, many times interpreted term. Even if public charge allows some play in the joints, as Your Honor asked, it does not reach the level of someone who accepts only supplemental benefits for as short a time as 12, 6, 3 months, whatever would be the cause of that person to be excluded or have their adjustment of status denied under the rule. These are supplemental benefits. That's why the non-cash difference has emerged. It's because the way the benefits work now, if someone accepted all supplemental benefits that are acceptable under the rule, you could not survive just on those benefits. But that may not be inherent to the statute.
As to the disabled, would a Stephen Hawking be deemed likely to be a public charge based on his need for lifelong, intensive, and extremely expensive government-sponsored health assistance?
As I read the rule, I believe he would.
All right, I think your time is up, so maybe we'll move along to the next person. Thank you very much, Ms. Flint. Mr. Morrison.
May it please the court, David Morrison as Special Assistant State's Attorney. Cook County and ICER have both established that they are suffering demonstrable and irreparable harm.
Now, can I ask you this, Mr. Morrison? Cook County and ICER, if you want to call it that, or this coalition, may not stand in exactly the same shoes from the point of view of Article III standing, and I don't like to call it prudential standing because the Supreme Court lectured us in Lexmark that we're not supposed to call it that, but zone of interest, let's say. But does it matter? If Cook County has standing, this case is properly here.
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Only need to have one plaintiff who has standing to have a case, and no case, and none of the cases that have been evaluated in the public charge have found that any of the plaintiffs lacked Article III standing. Cook County is a home rule, the only home rule county in Illinois, and has constitutional authority to exercise any power and perform any function pertaining to the government, including to protect for the public welfare. Cook County's health system is one of the largest in the country, and pursuant to its enabling ordinance, it must provide care regardless of a patient's ability to pay. It makes it the largest safety net in the region.
Counsel, let's say that. Oh, go ahead.
When you say it must provide health care, would that are there something that we might think of as physician office visits that applies to, or is that just the emergency rooms?
Cook County does not turn away people at the doors. It doesn't turn away people at the boundaries.
So just primary care physicians could be accessed by somebody?
My understanding is that it doesn't have any responsibility. It is the largest charity care provider in the region. And it's a good thing that the health system doesn't turn away people at the borders because, as you've noted, infectious diseases like coronavirus know no borders. And the key to effective health care is early diagnostic treatment, but what do you need for early diagnostic treatment?
Well, that's, I think, a point. It's cheaper to do the early diagnostic treatment than to do the back-end cure, you know, in the emergency room, which is why I think the government's argument that you're actually asking for more money to be spent when the purpose of this is to save money is not empirically well-founded.
Well,
Counsel, can you address the zone of interest point? Let's say that we agree with you that there's an Article III injury. Can you address the argument the government made in its briefs about zone of interest?
Well, the zone of interest is not a specially demanding test, particularly when the APA is involved. The plaintiffs need to only arguably fit within the zone of interest to be protected or marginally related to the purposes of the statute. Here, it's quite the logical leap for DHS and the regs, 84 Fed Reg 4170, to say that hospital systems, state agencies, and other organizations that provide public assistance to aliens in their households will suffer financial harm as a result of the rule's implementation. And then to suggest that those hospital systems, public assistance agencies, and local governments are not within the zone of interests to challenge the shift from the federal government to these other agencies. And in particular, with respect to ICER, it has 100 different organizations spread throughout the state of Illinois. Its core mission is to provide health and social services to the immigrant residents of Illinois. It has had to shift over $100,000 of resources, staff time, overtime, to address the effects of the rule. And it is also funded in part on a reimbursement model, which is strained by the
department. I think Judge Rovner has a question. Excuse me.
Cook County has projected this, the disenrollment effect of the new rule, and DHS has not challenged that number.
You're correct, Your Honor. In the record, the only evidence is the harm to the plaintiffs. The government put no harm into the as to the government or challenged the plaintiffs' harm that it established in the record, again, on a preliminary injunction basis. But the record
is the harm. Answer this: is the harm to Cook County then, in your view, or are you arguing the shift from the ability to deliver medical services, let's say, through the Cook County Health System, in a proactive way versus having to deliver much more expensive services at the back end?
That is one of the various harms. I mean, Cook County.
What are some others that you're relying on?
Well, Your Honor, Cook County has three different arms. There's going to be more expensive emergency care. There is a lower reimbursement because now people are not going to be taking the chilling effect of the rule is not just that there are people who are eligible for the benefits. There are people eligible for the benefits who will not take the benefits. That is the concern here. It's that in 1996, when the welfare laws were changed, eligible people who were entitled to Medicaid reduced by 3% and those entitled to SNAP reduced by 31%. It is the predictable effect of this rule that people that are eligible for the benefits, children of family members, spouses, because of the fear of the rule, will not accept the rule. And so another one of the harms is that every time you re-enroll or disenroll, it's another administrative burden of Cook County to achieve that. And then, of course, it's the charity care. It's the shift that when people no longer have Medicaid to provide them with health insurance, Cook County is the largest private charity care, will have to now come out of its pockets because it has to do that under its enabling ordinance.
You would have to absorb two-thirds of the costs. Given current events, we can easily measure the cost of outbreaks in areas where large groups of citizens refuse to vaccinate, for instance, within the ultra-conservative, or rather ultra-Orthodox communities in New York and certain communities in California. The costs are really inevitable and measurable, and not, I would say, unquantifiable, as the government argues.
Well, and they're predictable. They predicted it in the rule that those harms would occur, and this falls very much in line with the census case, where the government argued that it would be inappropriate for a non-citizen to fail to respond to a census question about citizenship. But Justice Roberts indicated that it's the predictable effect. Even if it's unlawful, we're going to have a chilling effect of people when we ask them a citizenship question or when we tell them that the possibility of using benefits could harm you. And it's an untenable choice to make someone choose between accepting health care or their immigration status. And that is the chilling effect that this law imposes.
Let me try this. I think you're certainly answering and then some why there's injury, in fact, from this. But if this regulation... If Cook County Hospital, Cook County itself, actually, because there's housing, there's, you know, other benefits, the food depository and so on, is in there, the government is still, the federal government is still relying on Cook County and its counterparts around the country as a partner in this overall effort to deal with part of the population that may require some assistance from time to time. So in that sense, this regulation couldn't exist without relying on you in part, and which is why I think you're maybe brought into this zone of interests. I don't know if the zone of interests means it has to benefit you. It's you are a part of the system, though.
We are an intentional part. They identify local governments and healthcare systems throughout the regulation and the rule as shifting the burden onto them and accepting that financial harm. And this fits squarely within this court and Supreme Court's jurisprudence on zone of interest.
Okay, well, I think you're out of time. Thank you very much. We will now hear briefly from amicus.
May it please the court, Will Haveman on behalf of the House of Representatives. Before I begin, I just want to thank the court for granting the House argument time in this important case. I don't want to duplicate efforts with my colleagues, Ms. Flint. I do want to emphasize that the term public charge has always meant, since Congress first enacted it in 1882, has always meant someone primarily dependent upon the government for support. And of course, Judge Barrett, of course, that definition has to be fleshed out, and I think that that's what we have seen the courts and the executive branch do over the course of the 20th century. And I think that the problem with Judge Bybee's opinion in the Ninth Circuit is that Judge Bybee understood those efforts to flesh out a meaning of the term public charge that has always been clear, that as someone primarily dependent on the government. He took the fact that the courts have, of course, had to flesh that out to mean that DHS has the authority to expand that provision beyond
the plain meaning.
But what
about the relationship between the Welfare Reform Act and the immigration laws and the tying in of the affidavit of support and the rendering ineligible for public benefits? Basically, pretty close correlation to the same people who are now subject to the public charge rule.
So that is true. And we think that it strongly disfavors DHS's argument for the following reason. It is true that Congress in the welfare reform statute generally made non-citizens ineligible for benefits, but it did not pursue that goal at all costs. And it said that certain non-citizens 5 years after becoming lawful permanent residents are eligible for those benefits. And I just want to emphasize what I think is sort of a perverse result of the reasoning of DHS's logic in this case. And that is that the more generous Congress decides to be with respect to granting non-citizens eligibility for certain benefits, the more generous Congress opts to be, the more discretion DHS has under the logic of this rule to exclude that class of non-citizens at the outset. And I think that the 2002 Farm Bill is actually an excellent example of this dynamic in practice. In the Welfare Reform Statute, of course, Congress made non-citizens generally ineligible to receive food stamps. 6 years later, after witnessing negative public health consequences of that decision, Congress changed course, and it said that non-citizens 5 years after becoming LPRs, 5 years into the pathway to citizenship, are entitled to receive food stamps. Now, under the logic of my colleague's argument this morning, that decision in 2002, in fact, gave DHS dramatically broad new authority to exclude that class of citizens at the outset because they are likely to receive food stamps at some point in the future. And that cannot be what Congress had in mind in 2002.
So you would say just there's a logical contradiction between saying you are now eligible for food stamps, but that means you can never stay.
But that rendered you ineligible at the outset.
That's a negative factor.
But
right.
That would, I mean, maybe I'm not tracking this fully, but if after 5 years and you're a permanent legal resident, and let's imagine that at some point you even get citizenship, you will be eligible for all kinds of benefits at that point. So what, I mean, you're saying then that, well, if someone who is subject to the public charge rule, who, you know, later on is likely to become a full citizen, let's say has a citizen spouse or something like that, and might at some point even post-citizenship when there's no restraint on means-tested benefits, you're saying that, well, then the logic of DHS's rule permits them to say, hey, you're likely to become a public charge 7 years from now?
Right. The logic of DHS's rule is that the more generous Congress opts to be with respect to providing a safety net for certain non-citizens who have been here for a long time, the more authority DHS has to exclude that very class of non-citizens at the outset. And I also just want to emphasize, in the time left, what I think is a point that if we step back, I think it is important to recognize just the transformational nature of this rule. And I don't want that to get lost. This is a provision that, since it was enacted in 1882, has applied narrowly. It has applied, I think the best estimate is recently, it applied to exclude about 3% of non-citizens from this country. We don't know how many people it will apply to in the future, because of course it's predictive, but we do know that more than half of the US-born population in this country at some point in their lives receives one of the benefits that, according to DHS's logic, is enough to earn you the label of a public charge and to exclude you from the country. And of course, the Chevron analysis is a question ultimately of congressional intent. So the question is, did Congress intend to allow the agency to adopt the interpretation that it has arrived at? And one factor that goes into that is just the scope of the change. And after 140 years in which this has always been interpreted narrowly, in the face of settled BIA authority interpreting the provision narrowly to exclude people who obtain welfare, it is highly unlikely that Congress wanted for the first time to allow DHS, in effect, to impose what is a wealth requirement on immigration into this country. I'm happy to answer any other questions, but thank you very much.
Judge Rovner?
If the Supreme Court ultimately finds that the interpretation is permissible, then the government's only injury would be that it had to use the same definition of public charge that it has used for over 100 years for a few months longer. Is that correct?
That is correct. The House has not briefed the preliminary injunction factors, but I do think that it is just true as a factual matter. This is the interpretation that's been in effect at least since 1999, we believe long before 1999. So it's difficult to articulate the irreparable harm.
And I do have one more question. Suppose an immigrant receives more than 12 months of aggregated benefits, but then later pays the government back for those benefits. Isn't she still considered likely to become a public charge based on the plain language of this statute?
Yes, that's right, and that's another reason why we don't think that the rule can be reconciled with the actual language of the statute that Congress passed and the decisions that Congress made in 1996. That is, we know that someone who has an affidavit of support, who actually receives benefits, is not deportable as a public charge if their sponsor can reimburse that cost. And in DHS's briefing, they talk about Congress being concerned with unreimbursed costs, but of course, many of these non-citizens are subject to the sponsorship provision. They therefore have sponsors who assume a legal obligation to reimburse the government for the costs.
For the first 5 years, right? Until they become
For the first 10 years. The sponsorship provisions are generally for 10 years at a time. So there is that period after 5 years, but before 10 years, in which a person may receive benefits. Congress contemplated that they would receive benefits, but they have a sponsor who, if the government asks, can reimburse the cost. That's what Congress had in mind, but under DHS's rule, that person would nonetheless be excludable at the outset as likely to become a public charge, and that's just inconsistent with the decision that Congress made in 1996.
All right, thank you very much, Mr. Haveman. And I said I would give you some more time. I think somehow or another, I'll add that up to a final 5 minutes, which is what you wanted.
Thank you, Your Honor. I just have a few points I would like to make. Just on the most recent point about Congress, of course, Congress has the authority to change the definition of public charge, and it has never defined the term. In fact,
isn't it a little absurd, the example we were just talking about, if a person has a sponsor and they use these benefits and every last cent is paid back, the DHS is still considering them a public charge?
Your Honor, they are not. In fact, if you've paid the benefits back and received them and paid them back, that's a factor that would be considered and would
weigh
in your favor.
It's only a factor though, right? But you were the one who was stressing totality of the circumstances.
Yes,
you
and
could
if it
actually
looks like you
keep
will
somebody out who paid it all back.
Well, Your Honor, if looking forward,
right,
it's likely that someone is going to use benefits. I don't think they're often paid back. But if someone is likely, and its determination is you are likely to pay this back, then that would be a heavily weighted factor.
Different issue. Actually, this court has had cases where the government has sued to enforce these agreements, and they're enforceable agreements.
They are, yes.
And they get enforced. If DHS's problem was a poor record of enforcement of agreements, then it seems the solution is to improve enforcement, not to just keep people out.
But I would keep in mind, of course, to enforce these things by bringing suit is a time-consuming, expensive process. If we know ahead of time, if DHS knows ahead of time, a person is going to use benefits for a significant period, then
what's a significant period?
It's as we, you know, it could
we're
have.
Back to,
I'm not saying it has a specific
months.
Definition.
Yeah.
This is the interpretation the rule has provided, that it will be 4 months. But that's again someone who's using the relying on the government.
Counsel, is it your position that you've been generous in defining it as 3 or 4 months? You know, or benefits in the aggregate totaled up to 12 months, but that you could, if you wanted to, define it as someone who imposed any public charge?
Your Honor, I want to be clear, and this was another point I want to make. We're not arguing, and this doesn't require the court to conclude that the agency has unfettered discretion. It, of course, is subject to rational decision-making and arbitrary and capricious decision-making.
I thought you argued that in your brief. I understood your brief quite clearly to say that the use of the term in the opinion of the Attorney General, which is the original statutory language, meant that there were absolutely no constraints on what the Attorney General could do.
Your Honor, we did not, I don't believe, argue that. We made clear that we're not arguing for unfettered discretion.
You didn't make it clear to me.
Could you say, like, hey, in our view, public charge, you know, you receive SNAP for 1 month and that's it, your public charge?
Your Honor, I mean, that would not be supported on the rationale that's been provided. The agency recognized that person who uses it temporarily or intermittently. Now,
no,
I'm not here today.
I understand how they, I mean, I guess, you know, so there's an academic debate about whether Chevron step two is distinct from arbitrary and capricious review. I guess what I'm asking you, and you keep kind of folding back into the regulation, but what I'm asking you is, could you, under your interpretation of the statute, is it the government's position that you could define it as 1 month of SNAP?
I mean, it's possible, but I don't know what the rationale, I mean, we'd have
it's
to see what the rationale.
It's possible? Like, you really do think you could interpret public charge that way?
I mean, I can't, we're not here talking about that.
Yes, well, we are. We're trying here to understand your understanding of the
Look,
statute.
Look, as I see this case, you know, there's the step one question the government reached, and then there's the step two question, which is, have you interpreted the statute reasonably? And then beyond that, there's a question of, has this rule reasonably implemented your interpretation? And I guess what I'm asking you is about that step two. I see what you've done here to implement your view. What I'm asking you is, do you think you have even broader discretion than that?
Well, I guess the short answer is we have, yes, we'd assume we'd have broader discretion, but we're only here today. The only question before this court is this particular rule a reasonable interpretation of the statute under step two? Is this particular set of, this
no,
narrow
but
set
it,
of
but
benefits?
We can't get there until we know what you mean.
I mean, there are some
areas in which executive authorities have virtually unlimited discretion. I can think, for example, in the immigration area itself, if somebody's trying to escape the one-year period of time to apply for asylum, the board decides whether there are extraordinary circumstances, and we say that's for the board. We're not going to decide whether they defined that right or not. And so I've had the question, you know, do you think this is one of those statutes that the Attorney General can define public charge any way he or she wants? Or are there limits?
We are not arguing for unreviewable, you know, discretion to define it any way we
okay.
want. All we're asking is, does this particular very specific definition, which set on particular benefits going to basic needs for a sustained period, you know, I know Your Honors have disagrees perhaps, but that's the definition.
So you do think it requires some significant period of time?
Under the rationale provided by the rule, yes, it does.
Some significant period of time and some degree of dependence.
I mean, yeah, I mean, now I'm not, you know,
so what's right? That, and you also must be arguing that the time periods defined in this regulation are significant enough, and the amount of dependence in this regulation is significant enough.
Yes,
you know,
and
a
if
week
you look
of
at,
SNAP benefits, you know, maybe
it wouldn't be
Medicaid
a week
for a couple of months. Sure, it could be a week of SNAP benefits.
I mean, that would only count as 1 month.
Right, and then, you know, as we've discussed, you stack it up.
Right, but I guess the question is, when we look, again, at congressional intent, look at the 1996 policy statements, which the other side is ignoring, where Congress says, we don't want aliens admitted to the country to rely on public support. We want them to rely on private.
I can't resist just saying this. Of course Congress said that, but then there's a question, what is a rational way to reach this? It's well established that if children have good nutrition, they do better in school, they learn better, they are more likely to become productive citizens, and productivity increases. There are 1,000 studies that show that. So if this rule says, no, we're going to have children experiencing hunger pangs all day in school because their parents don't dare put them under SNAP, that's a pretty irrational step if you believe the purpose just articulated.
If you take Congress's intent, which was that aliens admitted to the country should not be relying on the public, they should be relying on the private resources.
But that's the statement of purpose, and no statute pursues its purpose at all costs. So, well, then yes, that can undergird the statute, but that doesn't answer the specific question.
There's also statutory provisions. There's the affidavit of support provision, which says, look, if you can't get a sponsor, then you're automatically a public charge, and that sponsor has to agree to pay back the SNAP benefits that are paid. So Congress was clearly concerned about aliens receiving even those basic SNAP and other benefits. I just wanted to say one last
thought, and then we'll have to stop.
Okay, one last thought. Well, there are other things. I'll just mention the Rehabilitation Act and the question about disabilities. The rule makes quite clear that if it will only consider disabilities if a person is unable to work or will require medical care. So, again,
will require medical care, though, could mean that you're a diabetic.
At the government's expense. I mean,
could mean you're a diabetic and you have to get your insulin from the government, or could mean that, you know, you're HIV positive and need to get your antiretroviral drugs from the public.
And assuming you don't fit within one of the exceptions, then yes, you will not be qualified under the rule because you are relying on the government.
Because you're disabled.
No, because you are relying on the government to provide your medical care. And now it's the same for anyone.
If that's
it's not a solely based on disability test, and that's the test in the Rehabilitation Act. But in any event, Your Honor, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. Thanks to all counsel. The court will take this case under advisement, and we will take a recess of about 10 minutes.